Inspiring people across the planet to be a little kinder and a little more gentle with each other. Delivering inspirational TV, one story at a time, from my lounge to yours. I'm your host, Tony Lontis.
And good evening, America. Good morning, Australia. And welcome to Radio Tony Everyday Business. I have to say today has been another one of those challenging days with technology. Not only did my laptop crash, but Zoom dropped out in a breakfast networking meeting, and then it's dropped out a couple of times since. So let's have our fingers crossed that technology doesn't let us down through this show. Now, just a quick reminder, Radio Tony Everyday Business live streams into LinkedIn, Facebook, and on YouTube, so you can join us live there every week. You can also jump on to radiotony.com, where you'll find out about all our previous shows, all the replays, and all the information about the guests and the co-hosts that we have on the show. Radio Tony also has its own Facebook page where you can connect with me, like the page, and see what else is coming up. So this week and for the next 8 weeks, we are going to be joined by the gorgeous Lisa Coletta. And before I introduce you to her, here's a little bit about this wonderful person. Lisa is a passionate corporate governance change leader who leads a collective of senior specialists that shape, drive, and implement right-sized, efficient governance policy and related frameworks and processes holistically into businesses. Having worked in both the private and public sector with a career that spans well over 2 decades, in governance at varying levels, Lisa has defined and rejuvenated governance frameworks and processes, enabling effective decision making in organizations. She's done this through advising chairs, boards, committees, managing directors, and executives on corporate governance, enabling active and adaptive management approaches to aid in delivery of their business strategy. Lisa is passionate about coaching, guiding, and providing thought leadership to boards, executive management, and governance professionals. She relishes the opportunity to support the continuous improvement of their personal effectiveness, their mindsets, to enable the delivery of effective governance within their organization at both a strategic and operational level. Lisa holds a master's degree in management, a postgraduate applied corporate governance with the Governance Institute, and is a graduate of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, Company Directors Intensive Course. Lisa is also a certified neuro-linguistic programming coaching practitioner and a fellow of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, associate member of the Governance Institute, and is a member of the Australian Board of NLP. All important qualifications in the work that she does. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Tony. How are you?
I'm really excited to be here. I've been excited about this show for a number of weeks because Lisa and I have had some really fantastic conversations about leadership, and in particular, heart-centered leadership. And before we get on to what our next 8 shows or 7 shows now will look like, I wanted to talk about Lisa's personal journey in business. So Lisa, just tell me a little bit about growing up and what your aspirations for the future were like.
To start at the very, very beginning, I'm a first-generation Australian. I have European parents, a Maltese father and an Italian mother. And I was brought up in a quite loving environment, but a very European one in Western Sydney, here in Australia. My environment when I was growing up was a really interesting one. I'm the oldest daughter with 2 younger brothers. And from an educational perspective, my parents took a very different view to the education and the contribution to education to their sons than to their daughter. So I found myself attending my local public school, attending my local primary public high school, where my brothers were actually privately educated. My parents' view, I think, at the time really was that I was going to get married and have babies and stay home just like my mother did. And it wasn't really until I started, I was in high school, I left and started in the workforce, did I really realise that I had a lot of options, a lot of opportunities there that were far beyond the ideas of what my parents had for me. So, it was kind of a really interesting time. And those formative years really were not very focused on education from me or from my perspective. So,
yeah. Lisa, was that a struggle for you, or is it mainly looking back retrospectively that were you aware of the differences? Were you aware as a woman that you had? Because I know from my personal perspective, for me as well, there were just like you were going to be a bank teller, a nurse, or a teacher, and it kind of didn't go outside of those realms very much. And it wasn't till much later in life that I realized that there was a huge, big world out there and amazing opportunities for women. And that's not to denigrate my family. That's just the way that it was back then.
Look, absolutely. I think I was really happy with, I guess, what my parents had chosen for me. And one of the things I didn't really at time was that I actually had a choice. I wasn't very open to understanding that there were other options out there for me or other perspectives, because I didn't really feel I needed any other. I felt totally safe and entrusted in the advice that my parents were giving me at that time. It's interesting though that you talk about the concept of the doctor or the bank teller or whatever the clear simple lines were. Maybe not a doctor, but certainly a hairdresser or a bank teller. I remember when I first started getting into the corporate governance space, the first role I got was a really great middle leader, manager type role. And I remember ringing my mum up and going, "Oh, mum, I got this job. I'm so thrilled. It's, X, Y, Z role and whatever, whatever." And she said, "Oh, that's so great. I'm so proud of you." And a couple of days later, she actually said to me, "Lisa, why can't you be a hairdresser or a bank teller? Because I don't know how to explain what you do to my friends. It would be much easier if you were one of those, because then I'd be able to explain to people what it is that you do." And it wasn't because she wasn't proud, Tony. It was really more that it's just a really different paradigm, a really different world. And my parents were just not part of that world. That whole concept of me having options is just not something that they considered. So that's kind of, it's sort of one of those things that, it's perspective. Yes. Isn't it? We live and learn and grow in environments where we over time get more perspective and more of an understanding of where our options are. So, yeah.
So about what age did you discover a love for governance and processes?
That's a really good question. I do find, I know this is going to probably be a bit of a left field answer, but I actually couldn't quite pinpoint it, other than the fact that I was brought up in a very compliant household. And because I was brought up in a really compliant household, it wasn't that I loved the rules. It was more that I had to understand them to operate within them. And of course, at that time, being a child in a parent's household, you didn't get to choose the rules or define the rules. You only got to live within those rules or not comply with those rules. I did find that from a very, early on in my career, I did gravitate to more process-based roles. And that, I think, is mainly because of the nature of the type of organisations that I was in at that time. They were very process-oriented environments. But I did know myself well enough to know that while the process was there for us to follow, I always knew that there was always a different or a better way of doing things. And I was really fortunate because in quite a few environments where my leaders actually enabled me to make some changes when I felt they were needed, and that made a really big difference. So, yeah.
And do you think that sort of that might have triggered that whole love and passion for governance?
Look, I think it did. I think if anything, it actually enabled me to realise that things can always be made better and things can always be continually improved. Yes. And for me, it really is more about what we're working towards and what the outcome is. And once we're really clear on that, when a couple of really great heads come together and we talk through how things can be done better, I really believe that adage around 1 + 1 = 3, two heads together really can build a really, really amazingly fantastic outcome.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think that's totally right.
So you've had this wonderful long career in this space, and I'm sure you've got some interesting stories. Can you tell us about some of those?
Oh, look, absolutely. I've been fortunate that I've been in quite a few very varied environments, and I guess one of the things that I'd love to share with you and your listeners is a story around how I've kind of ended up where I am here today. I have worked in environments where there are a lot of rules. It was a very process-oriented environment. It was quite bureaucratic in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And some of those environments were very, very heavily controlled and managed by leaders who had certain leadership styles. And I guess for me, I found that quite a few of those leaders tended to have these hidden agendas or this sort of I guess behaviors that really, really sort of played out to them achieving personal gains over the broader organizational gains. Their motives were not always evident at the beginning. I did find, I think, early on that my I was quite naive to it, to be really frank, at the beginning.
Yes.
Because I was a good little compliant, Italian girl, I tended to just do what I was told until I started putting on to the fact that the motives of others weren't necessarily all that pure, and really getting very clear on the greater good of the organisation was more of a motivator for me than the personal power of those individuals. And so over time, I just found that as I guess, moved up the ranks in the organisation, I found that I had more authority and more of an opportunity to be a more heart-centred leader, to recognise that everyone can win in these situations, and individuals who are there for their own purposes and nothing else were doing themselves and the organisation a disservice, not to mention the fact that they were really, really hard to work around. Very, very hard.
I was just going to say that actually leads into that conversation of you're an emerging leader. You've got leaders over the top of you. How do you manage those difficult leaders?
It is really, really tough for some leaders to manage up. And what makes it even harder is that people are looking up to you. Your people are looking up and you're looking up. It's one of those things that I've actually found, Tony, that the more sure I am in where I'm coming from and what my motives are, from a really good heart-centered standpoint, the easier the process is. And part of that, of course, is having real conversations, because some of these more senior leaders tend to be quite avoidant, and they don't want to have the real conversation. They like to think that no one can see what they're doing because they don't want to face what they're doing themselves. They don't want other people's input or opinions. And so it can actually be quite hard, because you are, you know, getting from above, and, you know, you're getting pressure from below and you're getting pressure from above. And sometimes you can feel like you are that meat in the sandwich. So it really is about just really being really clear and quite centered around who you are and what you're there for and what your broader purpose is and what your motives are. I've been caught, I think a lot of people have been caught, in fact, Tony, where they just feel they need to play the same game as their leaders above them. I've been in environments early in where I've done that. I've actually been in places where I've gone along to get along, and things didn't sit right with me. And I got to a point where I couldn't not speak up any longer. And I realised quite quickly that it wasn't the right environment for me, and I didn't hold the right lines. As leaders, we all have the opportunity to have our own boundaries and hold appropriate lines, not just the governing lines in the organisation, but also our own personal lines as well. And those lines typically need to align with the values and behaviours of the organisation we work in as well. So it can be tough. But we can do, as individuals, we can do things to support ourselves and our people and those processes to not be completely immune from those senior leaders, but at least be open and direct around what the best interests are for the organisation and everyone who works in it. So,
yeah. So, Lisa, were you able to have those difficult conversations with those leaders? Because I'm very much thinking about my corporate life and some of the difficult personalities that I had to deal with. And I never quite got, like, I felt comfortable having my point of view and I felt comfortable openly talking about that, but having a one-on-one with a manager who was above me never really worked very well. And I always came out of those meetings feeling very bullied and like, it's okay to have your say, but then you've got to pull the company line. And you've either got to, as you say, you've either got to leave the organisation. It's very hard when your values and you can see leaders doing effectively the wrong thing or aligning things that interest them or advantage them over everyone else. And it's very hard to stay in that sort of environment. But lots of people do. And I'm really curious about strategies to do that.
Yeah, look, it's a really good question. I early in struggled quite a little bit as well, and I really found it depended on the personality of those individuals too. I did find for some of them they got really under my skin quite a lot, and it wasn't like they were passively bullying. They weren't aggressively openly attacking. They were kind of passively aggressively getting under my skin to the point where I'd walk out of meetings and go, it's exactly the same way you described it. Walk away going, oh, I feel violated. I feel like I've been pushed around. And I walked in knowing I was going to hold these lines and I didn't. And what I found that's been the most effective for me in those sort of situations is to be really clear about where what it is that you want to own from that conversation and what's actually theirs to own. Because the only thing you can ever do is control your own feelings and your own behaviours. You can't own the behaviours of the other person. And you can't actually own the feelings of the other person. So sometimes I found that those types of individuals tended to make me feel guilty about having an opinion when I had a right to have one. And I'd sort of stand back and go, well, I did actually have a right to have an opinion and it may not align with yours, but I'm being paid to provide that opinion. The organisation can choose to do whatever it is that they want to do. But what I do know is that I'm going to own my bit and I have to make you own yours. He may choose not to own it, and that's actually okay, but I can't carry that with me. So out of a lot of those conversations, Tony, we tend to end up owning the stuff that the person on the other side of the table isn't owning about themselves, and we end up carrying that with us. And that's the challenging part. It's sort of like take the learnings from it but leave the emotion behind and also recognise that it's part of that they need to own their bit, and you can't make them own it, but you shouldn't be carrying it either. And that's the really, really tough part of that. It really is. And it's kind of, it reminds me of this quote. I've just recently read Glennon Doyle's book, Untamed, and she talks about this quote around recognising how it feels to disappoint someone else. And it's a really, really great little quote. She actually refers to, I think it was a conversation with her daughter around the differences in disappointing someone else versus disappointing yourself. And it's a really lovely little anecdote because she actually talks about the realities of encouraging her daughter to always disappoint someone else if it's at the cost of maybe of disappointing yourself. And that's what it really comes down to. Because what tends to happen in those conversations, Tony, as you know, is that we end up walking out of those rooms going, oh, I should have said this and I didn't say that and I could have, should have, but didn't. And then you rehash the whole conversation over and over and over again. But when you walk out of those rooms not disappointing yourself, the rest of it is really on the other person and they can take it or they can leave it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find that good governance helps to manage some of the corporations where those issues exist? Do you think that that plays into that?
Look, it definitely does. It definitely does. And part of the reason why it does, and I see it a lot, I really do, I see it in organisations where they haven't got great governance structures in place and something as fundamental as defining the organisation's values is one of those areas. I have seen other organisations where they've got their values plastered everywhere And the tone in the top actually sets the tone. So the senior leaders, the board and the executive don't behave that way. Therefore, it's acceptable for everyone else to behave that way. So it's another thing to have good governance. And then it's another thing, again, to do good governance and be in an environment where you're actually, part of your being is actually following and delivering on that governance. Ideally, organisations would be hiring people who actually align with the organisation's values, and that's just where they are and who they are. So you never have this mismatch of personalities. But sometimes when individuals are allowed to cross lines and cross especially behavioural lines, they feel that that's the new norm, and they're able to, you know, it's been accepted as a new norm now, so then they can continue to behave that way. So absolutely. Governance.
So, Lisa, have you had the opportunity to work in organisations where there's that disconnect between the organisational values and what's being displayed in their leaders and managers and employees? And how did that work out?
Yes, I have. I have been in a couple of different organisations, and I've actually consulted quite a few as well, where either they don't have those values and behaviours set, or the owners of the organisation or the leaders of the organisations are choosing to set their own values and behaviours, even though the organisation already has some. It's a really interesting conversational quandary. And what I typically do when I walk into organisations like that is I actually look for those righteous, those real champions in the organisation that do know right from wrong and do understand how things really should be looking. Typically, those individuals aren't the decision makers, and they're the ones that aren't holding any level of power or authority. But what I do find is that those are the individuals that tend to lose their voice. They've lost their voice, or they just stop speaking. They just stop speaking up after a while. They just stick with it. Typically, they're the people that hire people like myself to help them in the organisation that they're in. And what tends to happen in those organisations is that there's some other imperative to get a corporate governance professional in, because in those environments, typically, if they're not complying with their with governance requirements, they're not actually complying with even other requirements too. So there's actually the organisation's actually not running very efficiently or effectively, or even they're at a point where, you know, maybe their funding's been taken off them from government or something like that, and all of a sudden they need to firefight. And that tends to be how I actually get brought in. And so, as I said, I look for these individuals. They're normally the stewards of some of those processes. And we actually work together to start building the governance for the culture that they want, not the culture that they have.
Yes.
And, and that's how it tends to play out. Sometimes, I guess, unfortunately, for some of these organisations, the backsides need to be on fire a little bit, or the CEOs or the board need to actually have some pressure, some outside pressure for them to actually accept that they need a little bit of support from someone like myself. So that's how it happens.
And is there often outside pressure in terms of governance? So I'm thinking from a perspective where they're taking on, say, a government contract of some description. And, of course, when you work with government, you have to have good governance frameworks. So they may get the contract and then retrospectively go, oops, I haven't got this sorted.
Absolutely, yeah. Look, absolutely. And what tends to happen in those situations, Tony, is that government would like, you know, want to undertake a review to have those organisations demonstrate how they're delivering against their contract or delivering against their compliance requirements. Yeah. And so, that definitely happens. And it happens especially too where there's this culture of where all the good news gets pushed up and all the bad news gets pushed down. We see quite a bit where the board think everything's sweet and fine, and the CEO, who's the managing director, who's actually the regulator of what the board sees and what the board doesn't, is pushing all this really great news up, but below the CEO there's absolute anarchy. And what can happen is that the organisation, as I said, you know, it's not complying with key requirements. They might have, you know, been awarded a great contract, or they might have even, you know, taken a grant or something like that. And all of a sudden they've got a report on, or they're actually audited on how efficient and how effective the organisation is running below that CEO level. and the board are none the wiser until they get the audit report and find that things aren't where they need to be.
And have you obviously do some of that work in auditing, and you get to deliver that information to a board.
I do.
How does that go?
Look, it's a really interesting thing. I think for some senior leaders, they forget that governance isn't a tell me process, it's a show me process. And so whenever we're undertaking any type of reviews in organisations around their governance frameworks or, you know, how effective certain processes are or whatever else, we ask them to show us. Some CEOs and MDs are really great at talking to the board about how great things are going, but sometimes the boards aren't used to actually asking the show me questions. They want to trust the CEO. They want great trust between the board and management. Every organisation wants that. However, the challenge tends to be when it comes to showing, it's actually really, really quite hard. So when I do need to present to a board and the news isn't great, aside from making sure they've got lots of coffee and lots of cheesecake, lots of sugar and lots of caffeine, I don't actually hold back any punches. I believe that openness and transparency and integrity is everything. So
absolutely.
For me, I tend to, do that openly and transparently. I do like to have pre-briefs. I don't feel that, you know, walking into a room without the chairman being aware and the managing director being aware of the outcomes is an appropriate way to go. I don't like to spring surprises on people. I'm not that kind of person. I know there are people out there that like to do the big review. I like to check in along the way, and I like to have openness and transparency. Part of the reason for that too is because people won't share with me what's really going on in the organisation if I don't have integrity around every part of the process and its approach. So,
Lisa, when you do that, do you do that as a one-on-one? Is it an email? How do you manage that process when the organisation is going through that?
So it tends to be in a couple of different ways. And it also depends on where in the process I'm actually up to as well. So, for example, if I was to be undertaking a review of an organisation's corporate governance framework, I would typically be spending a lot of time with their company secretary or their most senior governance professional, and we'd be doing check-ins time to time with the chair, normally informally and verbally.
Yes.
I like to interview key stakeholders and build really, really great trusting relationships anyway, because it makes it more effective, and the outcomes of the review are actually more reflective of what's really happening in the business. So I'd start with informal chats first, Tony, and then I like to provide a nice draft report for the senior management to review.
To read.
Mm-hmm. Have a read prior to going to the board, mainly to make sure that there's factual correctness, not for them as an opportunity for them to change my mind around what I've seen or what I haven't, contrary to some leaders' views. It's not actually appropriate for them to do that. I do like for them to see, you know, a draft report, get a real understanding. One of the main approaches I have with these types of work is that I'm not the police. I'm not there to find what's wrong.
I'm actually
there to recognise that there's an opportunity for enhancements. I can talk about what level of maturity they are right now, and I provide real recommendations around how they can fix what they've got going on. But I do it in a way that I like to think that gives them some flexibility and options, especially dependent on where that organisation is on the risk versus complexity versus the new sort of curve. It really just depends where they're at. And we have to be real about governance in a way that recognises that not every organisation wants to have BHP-level governance or, you know.
And nor do they need it, really.
Nor do they need it. You know, some organisations can actually have a maturity of, you know, between 1 to 5 or around a 2, and that adequately meets the requirements of their organisation from a governance standpoint.
Yeah.
I really feel strongly about things being right-sized. Not everyone needs level 5 maturity. You can have a level 2 and run a really, really great governance framework and really, really great performance metrics and all the rest of it, and it will work just as effectively. For me, it tends to come back to whose money is the organisation playing with.
Yes.
So if it's a business owner who is running their own business, they're on the ground every day, and they know
yes.
what's going on because they've got different mechanisms for transparency, the maturity levels of a two is totally fine. But if you're actually, if that yep. organisation is playing with other people's money, then the more yep. transparency they're going to need, the more embedding of key governance is really, really important.
Yeah.
But I like to think it's an underlying part of the way they do their work, not an add-on to everything else that's going on, because that, this word governance, it's one of those things, Tony, that some individuals really, really hate it. And the reason why they hate it.
Which leads me to the next question. Let's talk about governance in everyday terms. So when you're looking at governance, let's describe what that looks like. What does a governance framework look like? For listeners who are not familiar with these terms.
Sure. So governance for me is around defining, holding, and approving lines in an organization. And when I talk about lines, they're rules. They're rules.
Yes.
Sometimes these lines can be soft lines, principles-based rules. And there's an expectation in the organization that we pay really intelligent people to use their knowledge, skills, and experience and their judgment to apply principles, and we trust them to do that. So some of those lines can be principles-based lines, and some of them can be hard, non-negotiable lines. For example, delegations of authority. Certain roles can only spend a certain amount and not a cent more, and that's a hard line. Yeah. So when I talk about governance, I'm talking about the lines that are being set in an organisation, and those lines are typically defined in a policy document or framework that whatever your framework is, which is typically in policy. And policy, of course, Tony, is a response to the organisation's strategy. It's the move from it being strategic to starting to operationalize the strategy. It is still
strategic. This is what
policy.
It.
Oops, you're right.
No.
I'm
going to have to have a sip. I'm going to lose my voice.
Are you okay? Well, we need you to keep your voice safe. Have that sip of water. So policy. There's actually a hierarchy within a governance environment within any organization.
Yes.
Typically, they'd have a strategy. They'd have a business plan on how that strategy is going to be operationalized between 1, 2, and 3 years. And then some policy setting gets undertaken around where these new lines are for the operationalization of the business plan or of however they're going to be operating moving forward. And those policy positions, as I said, they're drawing and defining lines. Sometimes they're hard lines, sometimes they're principles-based lines. And the ongoing work in the governance space is really about making sure the lines are in the right place and making sure that people are actually staying within those lines. They're staying in their lines.
Yes.
And they're actually performing at the right level and doing the right work in the right place and space. So that is governance.
Yeah. Yes. Which is a lovely, simple explanation.
Oh, good.
Of the way things work. And when you're talking about governance, it's absolutely going to look different in different organisations and different corporate areas. The way that it's going to be very individual to the company, and I guess from your years of experience, you can readily see when you are not necessarily when you first step into a corporation, but after a number of weeks, you get a pretty clear idea of where their governance framework sits and who does what, where, and how and why.
Yeah, look, absolutely, most definitely. And what I find too is that the individual champions that are in that business tend to find me before I've got to find them. Every organisation has these key hidden gems that are real champions or real stewards for better practices, governance practices. Those individuals, I think, and this is probably quite biased of me to say this, but they're the unsung heroes in organisations because they're the ones that really are holding the governance structure and the demonstrable components of that together. They're the ones that you pull out when auditors come. They're the ones that are actually demonstrating that the organisation is doing the right thing in the right way at the right time. So I think everyone needs a pay rise, Tony. So anyone who's out there who's a governance professional can say that I said they deserve pay rises because it's really tough work and it's not very well recognised work
Agreed.
In organisations either. So it's
Agreed.
And it's important.
It is. And as you know, my experience in corporate governance comes from the healthcare sector. And yes, when you're talking about the stewards of the governance, I can actually see people's faces of the organizations that I've worked in because you know who they are. Because a lot of people, when you say that you're coming in to audit, so my experience was in quality. Health and safety in the healthcare sector. When you come in and say you're going to audit an organization, everyone goes into just a flip. And if they could just take a step back and realize that it's not about pointing out what you do wrong or right, it's about finding opportunities for the corporation or the business to do things better, which in turn will save you money and time and make your working life a whole heap better. And if you look at it from that perspective, auditing is an amazing tool for improving corporations and business, isn't it?
Oh, look, it absolutely is. And one of the things I think people lose sight of, especially when it comes to, auditors coming in and all the rest of it, whenever we're actually undertaking activities in an organization and we're spending time in, working within a process that isn't quite right or isn't actually aligned with what's actually required as part of our policies or whatever else, we're actually spending more time being inefficient. And the more time that we're inefficient, it's actually quite an unfortunate situation because the organization isn't utilizing their resources effectively to move them towards the ultimate goal. And the ultimate goal is really whatever's in the strategy and in the business plan. So these little bits and pieces, and people see them as just little annoying things as part of their daily job. But they actually add
Yes,
up
they do.
between every job and every person in that organization. They actually add up to quite significant little not just inefficiencies, but really they can, and what they tend
They
to
always
generate. Sorry, Jane.
equate to time and money, those little inefficiencies.
They
They
do.
always
And you know
equate to
what
time
happens
and
to them?
money.
You know what happens to them, Tony? Over time,
What's that?
they actually start compromising the risk position of the business. And ultimately, when it comes to, better governance practices, the more organizations can be on top of what's working and what's not and dealing with what's not working, the more they can actually realign their resources to move towards their goals, and the strategic intent of the business. Those little niggly little bits and pieces of stuff that auditors find, the sooner the organisation can take them as a gift and deal with them and get on with them, the less likely the risks that the organisation doesn't want to face actually end up being realised. It all comes back to risk, Tony. It all comes back to
I was
risk.
just going to say,
Absolutely.
So that's also part of what you do is risk management, which we will be talking about in one of our shows coming up. But the other thing that I wanted to ask this morning, are there key differences between public and private sector organizations and corporations?
Look, there is some differences, and obviously there are differences with how they're actually structured. There's differences in how they're regulated. There are differences in how the stakeholders' expectations can be a little bit different, although not hugely different. But when it comes to the governance in organisations, it's not actually hugely different. While there is different regulatory requirements, there are still better governance practices that every organisation can undertake, regardless whether you're small and privately owned, whether you're a publicly listed organisation, whether you're a state-owned corporation, whether you are a government department, whether you are an association, whether you're a not-for-profit. There are still some fundamental things from a better governance standpoint every organisation can benefit from. And again, it's about that being right-sized and being an underlying part of the way that the work is done in the organisation. So definitely, yes.
So, Lisa, what do you think, drives your passion around governance? Is it that, like me, you like to have rules to play by. That's the way I kind of describe it. I like to have rules. I like to have processes to follow. But conversely, I am equally confident to step outside and try something different. Is that what drives your passion around this area of work?
It's a really good question, Tony. I think for me, I like to have the right rules in place for the right reasons.
Yes.
And so yep. I guess I'm one of those people, and I'll be the first to admit that as a corporate governance professional, I should never say this, but I actually don't like rules. I don't like rules when they're placed on top of other people and they're placed on yes. you as a heavy burden, and they're this kind of, because to me there's a difference between power and authority. And when
yes.
when the power players at upper level management decide to place authority over other people, therefore trying to
yes.
control and manage them, and they're using the governance framework as the rules to control them, to, you know, remember that they need to all be grateful that they're employed
yep.
here, or whatever it is that goes on in those heads of theirs.
Yeah.
I just fundamentally, within my very, very core and being, have like a fundamental concern about the level of, I guess, from a culture standpoint, the level of
yes.
Buy-in and win-win environment that the individuals are actually creating
yes.
in those environments. So for me,
yes.
I do love governance. I love it when it's right. And you know when it's right.
Uh-huh.
Because the right rules and the right processes are in place in the right way where everybody wins. It's not about me. It's about we. And it's about everyone moving towards their goals. And look, sometimes, Tony, those rules can actually be rub against people a certain way. And sometimes,
yes.
unfortunately,
yes.
it's because they're actually not in the right role and they're not playing at the right level. So sometimes, for example, we can put a great policy in place that means certain roles can do certain things in certain ways, but some individuals may be playing in roles that aren't actually the right roles for them. They may need to be a little bit
yeah.
more strategic, and they need to be in a different type of role to be able to use the gifts that they have. I love governance, but it has to be right. It has to be that right,
yes.
sort of right way and right set governance. So, yeah.
Because if you get the right people with the right skills doing the right roles, it makes yep. a huge difference not only to the culture of an organisation or business, it actually is good business, isn't it?
It is absolutely good business. I've walked into quite a few organisations, Tony, where I found these hidden gems, these amazing
yep.
individuals that have been plodding along in a bit more of a basic process role, being grateful to have
yes.
the job, and the organisations are not leveraging their amazing talents and their amazing skills in a much more effective way. And it
yeah.
means a lot, not just for the organisation to leverage their great people, but also means a lot to that individual to be valued for who they truly are and what they can offer. So,
and that has a huge flow-on effect.
It has a huge, huge knock-on effect, absolutely huge. You want your people to kind of, you know, bounce into work every day happy to be there, as opposed to going, oh, here we go again, another day, another dollar.
Yeah.
And they're doing what they have to, not what they want to.
Yeah.
They're doing what they have to.
I'm guessing that you've had the opportunity to take organisations from a place where you walk in and go, oh, my God, I just want to walk back out again, to, oh, wow. And so in doing that, is there an average time that it takes, or is it a very individual thing based on the business that you're working with?
So it's there is, I guess, two answers to that question. But it is about the organisation
yes.
and where they're at.
But
typically there's only probably two or three policy or process areas that an organisation needs to improve, to lift the
mm-hmm.
morale and to actually shift or start shifting the culture towards something that is, much more amenable for the objective
yeah.
that the organisation is working towards. For example, I work for an organisation, I did some services for an organisation recently, where a business owner was running his own show, and they didn't have a formal recruitment policy in place. So what tended to happen
right.
in that organisation was that people were promoted based on merit, but they were also based on who knew the owner and how much the owner knew about them and what their personal
yeah.
passions or next steps were. So for some individuals, they weren't very good at selling who they were and what they did in that environment. But if a job came up, they'd apply for it. But there was no formal process or mechanism to do that. So it might be something as simple as, you know, implementing a recruitment policy that, outlines how all the jobs are going to be delivered moving forward. That's sort of one example. For other examples, I guess, it really just depends on what keeps the senior leaders awake at night. And whether the senior leaders are really, they've got the right processes to check in and see where their people's heads are at. Because sometimes leaders have got a lot of self-awareness, Tony. They don't know that there's a problem because people keep turning up every day and stuff seems to be getting done. And it isn't until you actually do a little bit of a pulse check around what's going on in your business. And I tend to do these little pulse checks as part of implementing a risk management process. Once businesses start monitoring risk and providing a mechanism, and I'd like a little weekly sort of check-in pulse check across the organisation to hear what's going on, that leaders can really start realising where are their opportunities for improvement, and typically morale and the culture tends to come up quite a lot then. Otherwise, leaders are quite, sometimes they can be quite blinkered or quite blind to the suffering around them sometimes, unfortunately. Especially if they're causing it, they're not even aware that they're doing that. So,
Is that a hard conversation too when you've got to go to a leader and say, well, look, your culture's this and, you know.
Look, I typically I find that the leaders know something's wrong and they just can't pinpoint it or put their finger on it. Or they think the problem is X, but the problem is really Y, and some of that Y is actually them. It tends to be a bit of that as well because they don't have that self-awareness. So I'll talk to them about X, but I'll also talk about that Y piece. The little pulse check process, I know we're going to talk about it on another show, but that's a really great example where I find that that little pulse check, it's important because sometimes leaders communicate, as I mentioned to you earlier, the good news up and the bad news are pushed down. When you do a little pulse check of what's going on in your organisation and you do it with a cross-section of staff, you're actually hearing for people that don't normally have a voice because their leaders will not, they might be communicating to their leader that they've got a concern or an issue, but they're not actually communicating that up because they're actually, each leader will filter what they believe is important to actually escalate up to the more senior levels. And when they're filtering, sometimes they're using their own conditioning and their own judgment to work out what they think's important and what isn't. And it's hard when, as I said to you earlier, some boards think everything's great, but in actual fact, they're not actually speaking to the right levels. They're not hearing from the right levels in the right way to really get a good picture of what's going on there. Some board members, in fact, Tony, tend to actually start befriending staff at lower levels, which is typically not an appropriate thing to do, but it's because they, the distrust is so high between the board and the CEO that they feel like they need another mechanism to find out what's really going on. And what tends to happen is I've got the CEO or the managing director coming to me saying, my board members keep coming to our lower level staff and blah, 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 stop them from doing that, Lisa. And I sort of stand back and go, well, okay, let me understand the dynamics. And when I speak to the board, they don't feel they're hearing, they don't feel like they're actually getting the truth or the whole truth or the whole picture.
Yeah.
That's where they do it.
So they want to hear from the people who do the everyday running and processes of the business as well as from the CEO, but they like to hear the mundane as well.
Look, look, they do, but they need to hear it, keeping in mind that every role, as I said earlier, there are lines around where each role plays. The board need to have the right mechanisms to have trust that whatever they're being offered up is true and correct, because they're using whatever they're being given by the CEO or whoever else for decision making. One of the key outcomes of a great corporate governance framework is a really effective decision making environment for the board.
Yep.
And that's why monitoring risk is so important and understanding the whole picture is so important, because board members, chairs and board members need to have the whole picture to make the best decisions for the organisation. And that's tends to be how it plays out. So,
And you do lots of work talking to boards, and we'll go into that for another show. Just quickly before we run out of time, I'm just going to talk about what we're going to do next week. So next week we want to talk about business and corporate governance, but why organizational structure is so important, what processes underpin our organizational structure. We want to talk about operations, risk management, ethical issues. And the other one that I wanted to touch on next week is corporations being investor ready and trust and transparency. So quite a lot to cover in next week's show. But before we run out of time, I just want you to tell everyone how they can connect with you at the Governance Collective.
Tony, the best way for everyone to connect with us at the Governance Collective is to pop us an email at support@governancecollective.com. You're also welcome to link with me on LinkedIn. You'll find me. I'm the only Lisa Coletta there. And you're welcome to message me through LinkedIn. Either of those two mechanisms would be really great. Love to hear from you.
And if you don't remember that, Radio Tony, our co-host section on the Radio Tony website, has all of Lisa's contact information, her websites, everything that she does will be on there as well. But that's thegovernancecollective.com.au, and email Lisa using support@governancecollective.com. And so, Lisa, over the next few weeks, we will continue to talk about all the different elements of the amazing work you do with business, corporations, auditing. You do executive coaching, you coach board members, you work with executives and CEOs. So we've got quite a lot that we want to cover over the next 7 weeks. I'm really delighted that we've been able to get through this first show with no technical issues. I'm already seeing the wealth of knowledge and information that you'll be able to give to listeners of our upcoming shows. So thank you everyone for joining us today on Radio Tony Everyday Business with Lisa Coletta. And Lisa's from the Governance Collective, and her work is around governance, obviously, but working with corporations, business and organizations to make sure that they have the basics in place. And it's a pleasure to have you with me today, Lisa. And thanks, I think that we are completely out of time already. And I look forward to another show next week. So thanks very much, Lisa.
Thank you so much, Tony. Thank you all.
And we will see you all next week on Radio Tony Everyday Business with Lisa Coletta and the Governance Collective. Join us then. Over to you, TJ. Bye for now, everyone. Thank you for watching and listening to Tony TV. For more inspirational stories, join us next week. Bye for now.